Hi, Eugene here. This past weekend was Stan Lee's LA Comic-Con in downtown Los Angeles. Lots of great stuff to see, but I was really surprised to see the original screen-used TARDIS console prop from the 1996 Doctor Who TV movie. This is one of the only surviving TARDIS consoles from the classic series and the only one in the US, and happens to be one of my favorite versions of the console. Paul Salamoff had a booth with the prop. Check him out on Twitter, he's got a lot of projects going on. Thanks again to Paul for sharing this wonderful prop with us, and hope to see you next year at LA Comic Con.
Welcome to Who Knew? We are fans of the current series of Doctor Who, and here we discuss our likes, dislikes, and insights into the modern regeneration of the show. Visit our website, whonewpodcast.com, email us at whonewpodcast@gmail.com, find us on Twitter and on Facebook at Who Knew Podcast. Subscribe, review, and listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher, or our YouTube channel, youtube.com/whonewpodcast. Today's episode is The Family of Blood, episode 9 of season 3. We pick up right where human nature left off. This episode is written by Paul Cornell, directed by Charles Palmer. It originally aired on the 2nd of June, 2007, and the overnight ratings were 6.6 million viewers. Let's introduce ourselves.
Hi, I'm Frank.
This is Arlene.
Hello, this is Auburn.
This is Josh.
Hi, this is Kelsey.
Hi, this is Brian.
And this is Eugene. At the dance, Martha and Joan are held at gunpoint while John Smith whimpers. Tim opens the watch to distract the family. Martha is able to get the gun away from Mother and points it at the family, which allows everyone to escape. She meets up with John and Joan, and they all run to the school. John alerts the students and arms them for war as the family and their scarecrows arrive outside the gates. The headmaster goes outside to talk with Baines and Mother, who say that everyone will live as long as they hand over Mr. Smith. Meanwhile, Father heads west to find out what Martha was hiding and discovers the TARDIS. He surrounds it with soldiers so the Doctor cannot escape.
Try it, we'll die together, and do you want to risk it?
Love those lines.
Yeah.
Sure, I'm scared. Yeah, do you want to risk it with a gun?
Yeah, a scared person with a gun. Is that really what you want someone to be like?
And then she's also like, all right, everybody, you know, Doctor, get them out. And John Smith doesn't do anything. And Joan is the one who picks up the slack and says, all right, everybody, start moving out.
Mm-hmm.
John is kind of useless in that moment.
Kind of rubbish as a human.
Yes.
Yes.
She says, God, you're rubbish as a human. I also like, too, how Martha's sussing out the mother character to see if there's any of her friend left in there before she kills her.
Yes. Yeah. Very sad, though, that the bodies, those people are definitely dead.
Yeah, they're disintegrated. Well, I like how this one picks up, because usually it picks up right where the last one left off, and then it goes into a weird lull as far as pacing. This one just picks right up. We're going to the school, and we're arming ourselves. It keeps the momentum going from the first episode.
It's what Kelsey has said before. You have this cliffhanger, and then it's resolved in 2 minutes, and you're onto a different part of the story that has nothing to do with the cliffhanger. And I like that Tim was scared of the Doctor, because what he's seen. And he's seen how menacing the Doctor can be, how powerful the Doctor can be, and how he can use that to kill. I mean, there's some of the visions where they're, you know, going after the Rachnos and all that kind of stuff, going, the Doctor is terrifying.
Tim is slowly using the watch to help defeat the bad guys as well. Like, at first I was like, what is he doing? Why is he doing that? And then I realized, oh, so he is kind of like, you know, boning up to...
He realizes it's a distraction.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of that is Tim and how much is the watch.
Yeah, the watch. He did say the watch was telling him to do some of it, not all of it.
Right.
Yeah, so I think it was a little bit of both.
Martha searches for the watch with Joan following her. Joan tries to comprehend what is going on as Martha explains everything to her. Joan leaves, knowing that the students will need her as their nurse. She meets up with John and questions him about his past. She also tries to convince him that the students are too young to fight, but he has no other choice. The school continues to prepare for war as Baines calls forth more Scarecrow soldiers. Hutchinson tells Tim that they might die, but Tim knows they will not because of his vision. He has seen them fight together in the coming war and wonders if having the watch may help them survive. He runs to keep the watch safely hidden and to think. Hutchinson calls him a coward.
Every time, sir.
Going back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But when they first return to the school, I think the last thing that Martha said to John is, you're rubbish as a human. And then they get to the school, and John suddenly starts calling everybody out. We're going to go to war or whatever. And the look on Martha's face is just like shock. As a viewer, I was also shocked because it's like the exact opposite, I feel, of what the Doctor would have done.
Because the Doctor may have gone somewhere different where he wouldn't be in an area where he'd have danger for the kids. He would have gone back to the school.
He would have went to a quarry.
Well, I think, too, it's the Doctor would still have fought, but in his own way. But because he's been programmed to be John Smith, this is what John Smith is known. You know, he's training kids to be soldiers. He's a teacher. He's living in this time. And then, I don't know, you haven't read it yet, but when it comes down to him actually firing, you know, we see what happens.
Yeah.
Right, right. It is, but it is a time period, and he is going... These people are coming to kill. This is the best way to fight them.
Yeah, but I think it's all part of the persona that's been imprinted on him.
Right.
And it doesn't hold because when it comes to fruition, the true Doctor comes out.
Yeah. I really like the part where he calls him a coward and he runs off.
It's like a callback to the Ninth Doctor.
Yes, mm-hmm. It's totally a callback. And it's like he's starting to like get some of that courage and that persona from the Watch. And it's like... He's starting to understand when he said, I wonder if this watch is going to help me, because he's starting to understand, wait, I am going to be a soldier. I am going to do better. And I know that this is going to do something to change me in the future. I don't know what it is yet, but I'm going to listen to it. And I am going, like, you may call me a coward, but this is the bravest thing to do. So it was right. Just amazing. I just thought it was like such a character building moment. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You said it was a callback. Do you want to clarify to where?
Yeah, it's a callback to the Parting of the Ways with Eccleston's Ninth Doctor. He has that bomb ready that could destroy all the Daleks and half of Earth. And the Dalek Emperor toys with him, saying, what are you going to be? Are you going to be a warrior or are you going to be a coward? And the Doctor says, coward any day. And the producers and the writer, they were doing it. They said, because they were kind of giving Tim some Doctor-esque qualities. Mm-hmm. And they were doing this callback to just kind of tie Tim and the Doctor together just a little bit.
I like the music that I was playing as they're getting ready for war.
The fife and drum?
Yes.
Is that the children really well. I like singing?
No, this was that's instrumental.
Frank's talking about the one which is literally like the fife and drum, like Revolutionary War.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, know, yeah. No,
and
I,
a march,
I like
kind
that
of
too.
A, you're get, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, the hymn you're talking about, though, is He Who Would Valiant Be. And they play that in the first episode when the kids are marching up the flagpole shot. And then they play it again in this episode.
Is that like a war hymn?
I don't think so.
I like the scene between Joan and Martha.
It's an excellent scene.
Where Martha's saying, no, I'm a doctor. I took my lessons. Mm-hmm. And that's too far for Joan to believe.
Aliens, maybe.
Yes, aliens, maybe. But
a black woman, a physician?
And that, rather than arguing with her, it was like, I love that Martha's, this is all I know. These are all the, you know, bones of the hand and going through them all. And just off the top of her head, knowing it. It's like the best way to prove it, rather than arguing. Going, I have that information. I do know that.
And I love the... And the reaction. You read that in a book.
Of course.
Yeah.
You had to study.
To pass an exam.
Yeah. I also like Joan saying, you know, I am these boys' nurse. Mm-hmm. So I am going to go down there. You know, I'm going to go into harm's way because those boys are going to need me.
And she was trying to understand.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
She wasn't making fun.
She wasn't
dismissing either.
Right. But yeah. It was just like, in my world, that's not. And then all the information keeps coming in. And then that is, I have to do my job. I have
and
to
also
do what's
too,
important.
This whole episode, Joan has the journal. So it's like she's constantly referring to the journal to figure out what the heck is going on.
And she's finding out other things that the journal's real.
Right.
It's not just dreams. And then I like when she goes down to talk to the doctor about, tell me about this. Tell me about Nottingham. Tell me all this stuff to go
on. It's like reading an encyclopedia.
I need to know the truth. And you're not telling me the truth. And you don't even know the truth.
It's like a Wikipedia entry.
Just trying to believe the unconceivable is truth. And just like... I need proof. And it's like, you're giving it to me and I don't like that.
which is really interesting to me because they're really talking love now. Like they love each other. And she knows that it's like all starting to click that he's not real, but she still loves this idea. And it's like, how does she continue to love this idea and think that the idea is the better
version?
The better version. That's what it's.
She doesn't know how much is real. Like he was saying, our kiss is real. What we have is real. This other story, I don't know what that is. It's just a story, but their bond is what she's holding on to, even if everything else changes.
It's also, she's in the midst of figuring, of dealing with this. It's not like, I guess I feel this way now. You know, it's letting go. Like, she finally let herself love again after her husband died. And in the midst of this crazy thing that's happening, she's trying to think logically about something emotional during something incredibly visceral and physical. So it's everything is acting against every aspect of it.
Yeah, which I think is pretty, I think it's cool. It's wonderful the way it's written because of all of that, because she gets it, yet it's still in this realm of super confusion.
Right.
Right.
And she, and the actress totally sells it.
And it, like, later on, as we'll probably get to it, but the John Smith does it.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering that too, like, how much of it is John Smith doesn't get it, or it's like the way he couldn't see the watch. He could, what was it called?
Perception filter.
A perception filter. Almost like there's a perception filter over this truth. So that could be why he is so resistant.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, that makes me feel better about John Smith.
It's part of the perception filter to the watch.
That you are
not
this?
The doctor.
I go the other way. He is just so completely John Smith.
Which then again,
I don't want to go.
Gets me to a place where, like, how could she fall for John Smith?
We also get that kind of that remembrance of war that we talked about in the previous episode. So the headmaster, you know, it's like, war, don't make war glorious. And he's like, don't say that to me. I fought in war.
Right.
You know, I did my duty for king and country, and I used dear friends' bodies as
sandbags.
You know, it's like, I know what war is, but sometimes you have to just do what you have to do.
And I like that this headmaster seems like he's going to be an archetypal person you hate, like you know, the principal of the school who doesn't understand people or doesn't understand kids, and someone who's essentially a villain. But he actually turns out to be quite a thorough human being. And what you just said, how he used his friends' bodies as sandbags. So he's actually someone of substance, not someone who's just a hoity-toity...
upper class.
Someone who's upper class, who's never been to war.
They gave the character depth.
Yes, yes, and understanding. So even when he was harsh, you kind of sided with him.
Which is what I think Doctor Who is great at doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love that about it, the show.
What did you think of the line of, you know, well, who are you to him? Oh, just a companion, just a friend. Oh, I'm not a rival to you. And then she's like, well, I'm doing my duty as much as you are. But it is bringing back that jealousy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. I was confused. I didn't know why she said I'm not a rival. And I was like, a rival of the doctor? I was so confused.
We are
she
not
was
romantically
telling
linked.
Joan, like,
or
she
that,
did?
Or there was a romantic thing between the doctor and I.
Oh, between her and the doctor. So. Yeah. John Smith isn't going to leave you to become the doctor so you can be with me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and she is saying that. And Martha's saying that with...
I was very confused about that. I was like, why does she keep saying I'm not a rival?
Because she's already gone through that acceptance scene, which I think was in the last episode, where she's just like, he's finally human, he's in love, and it's not me.
Yeah.
So she's sort of like, all right, I had that moment already. So this is sort of referring back to that.
Do you think if... Okay, just, I know this is a shoulda, coulda, woulda kind of thing, but if Rose was a companion at this point... Would he have fallen for Rose, or would it still be?
Yeah, I don't think Rose would have let him fall for Joan.
Yeah, she would have butted in.
She was like, no way, this is not happening.
Yeah.
Which would have fallen for Joan?
Which
you think he would have fallen
I think
for Joan?
He would have, because Rose would have been a schoolgirl. Again, it was just because...
No, she would have been
a maid.
But yes, you're right.
But you
see,
that's the thing. But Rose wouldn't have allowed it.
No, she wouldn't have. But, no. But he would have... That would have been his natural instinct.
She's like... This watch is opening.
Yeah, she totally would have. Yeah.
Sister infiltrates the school and finds Tim in a hallway. The watch tells him to beware of her, and he knows she is something other than a little girl. He opens the watch and shows her an image of a merciless doctor. She runs away and communicates with Baines and Mother that the Time Lord is in the watch. Their priority is no longer John Smith, but the watch, so Baines orders the Scarecrows to attack.
And the image of the merciless doctor is the Rachnos.
From
That's right.
The Runaway Bride.
Yes.
It was odd to use that as a weapon, the watch. It's like, don't open it, don't open it, and then do, boom.
That's funny. I thought it was an odd choice, too, when I watched it. I thought when he was, like, talking, I'm like, oh, you're in the form of a little girl. How strong are you? That he was going to walk up and, like, punch her or something. And then he opened the watch. I was like, oh.
I view it as what Tim is seeing in the watch scares the hell out of him.
Right.
It's you're a human being. I'm scared to death of what's in this watch. Guess what? Now you're going to be scared too. That's how I view it.
That's exactly how I saw it. Because it is scary. That view of the doctor is very scary.
Yeah, you want to see something scary? I'll show you something scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took it more literal of, you're an alien. You may have been strong and powerful, but now you put yourself in a little girl.
That's it too.
You know, so it's like, can you handle this?
It's both of those.
Okay.
Tim would be a good companion.
Joan would be a good companion.
I know, but I'm talking about Tim at the moment.
I'm talking about Joan.
Don't be ageist.
I agree. And then his specialabilities would help. He can what?
He can warg.
From Game of Thrones.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, this kid only takes roles where he's psychic.
It's in his contract.
The students hold the scarecrows back with rifles and machine guns. After the guns cease firing, the headmaster goes forward to check the bodies and confirms that the scarecrow army is just straw. They haven't killed anyone. Daughter arrives, and Martha, Joan, and John warn the headmaster to stay away from her. The headmaster will not let a little girl roam alone during this fight, so he tries to bring her inside, but she kills him. Baines arrives and reanimates the scarecrows, and they chase everyone into the school. Some of the boys escape and head away from the village, but those who are captured by the scarecrows are brought before Daughter in an attempt to identify which one of them has the watch. Upstairs, Tim opens the watch again, and the family goes on the hunt.
So the battle scene is where you hear the hymn, right?
When they're getting ready.
Yeah, when they're getting ready. Yeah.
The hymn was the last episode.
Yeah. No, it's also in this episode.
Yeah, it is. Okay.
But I wrote down after the gun ceased firing. So yes, in here.
Yeah, because the montage is the fife and drum.
Yes, that's right.
You're right. This is where it's
right here.
Plays. I mean, that's how impactful that it is, the firing and starting. The kids are crying, doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
And the doctor doesn't shoot.
But when they're all getting ready, there's that very dramatic shot of him aiming. And the wind's blowing his hair and all this stuff. It looks like, wow, he's really standing his ground and manning up for this. And then he doesn't.
At this point, everyone, including John Smith, believes that there are people inside scarecrow costumes. You know, that's why it's, you know, such a weighty scene, because these boys think they're killing people. John Smith thinks these boys are killing people, and I think that, you know, I think it can be I think you can see it both ways. You can see that John Smith is realizing the weight of war, or it's the doctor deep down in John Smith preventing him from firing a weapon.
I think it's both.
For me, it's more of the loss of innocence, because these are kids, and then now they're introduced to something that is adult, like killing. And I got that same feeling watching it just now from Lord of the Rings, where they're all at the council and they're saying somebody has to turn this ring and drop it into the, and then Frodo just raises it, I'll do it, and then you see that look on Gandalf's face, no, it's the innocent is now not innocent.
Do you know what the specific direction he was given to play that scene?
No, I don't.
The specific direction was, Gandalf, play that as your son has just gone off to World War I.
And see, that's why it fits with this scene. Mm-hmm.
But it's just so hard for me, because the doctor, if he was put into that situation, probably would have jumped over the kids and shot all the scarecrows instead of them. I will take the brunt of carrying that weight of war and loss and killing instead of you. That's just the time war. He chose to make that decision. Mm. But I will carry that weight. I don't want you to carry that weight. I will carry the burden of all of this. And that's the character of the doctor. And it just shows how far from the doctor John Smith is.
To me, that is not a reminder that this is not the doctor. That's a reminder that this is the doctor, because the doctor doesn't fire guns.
Right. That's how I took it.
And this, if we had seen the doctor firing his weapon along with everybody else, that is not the doctor.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That the is doctor not the guns. Doctor. The I doctor all, hates guns.
I think all the other stuff that we were talking about is what we're supposed to think about for the scene itself. But him not firing is the doctor doesn't fire a gun.
Yeah, it just seems so cowardly to me. And even the doctor being deep down inside, he wouldn't be in that situation.
But he did say he'd be a coward every day.
Yeah.
But I think the look on his face.
No, to me, the look on his face does not compute. The doctor needs to fix this. But he's John Smith now. So the only thing John Smith knows to do is this path. But he still is the doctor, and his true self won't let him pull the trigger.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even understand why he can't pull the trigger.
Cause I like that better.
Because in his face, it's like, how did we get to this point? In his face, I don't see it as cowardice. I do see fear, but I don't see cowardice.
Realization?
But it's loss of innocence. Where?
That was me.
Oh.
But I see it in his face as everything. Yes, I do see fear there. I don't go so far as to say cowardice. But it is also, why are we at this point? Who are these people? Look at these kids with the loss of innocence. Plus, at the same time, I've got this scary maid who I inherently trust telling me that I'm not human, a human being. I mean, so much is going on that it's just rattling his brain.
John Smith would fire, or he's not truly John Smith, because he's sort of got half of this personas. There are things in place that are preventing him from being a full person. And he's not the doctor because those things were put in a box. So he's not a complete person in either way to be in this moment, to make a worthwhile decision on what to do. And I think that's what the look on his face is. It's, again, it's all these things that we're talking about put into this man who is frozen with confusion.
This battle was foreshadowed in the first episode. Mostly, I'm thinking when Tim and Hutchinson were shooting at the dummies, which looked like
scarecrows.
Mm-hmm. And Tim didn't want to, and he's like, no, we fought this. We fought down in Africa. And Tim turned and said, and they only had spears.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he was saying that the dummies only had spears, but it was also
It was for the fight. And that feeling of, we are overpowered, we're using these weapons, and they only have spears, is, I think, mimicked in this, where the kids think they're firing at people who are in just costumes without the weapons, and they're all, you know, they're all crying and seeing that. So that's the same feeling and thing that Tim was trying to convey. It's like, you're for firing all these people who are unarmed, and we're just killing them. So that's, I thought, was, you know, foreshadowed in the other episode. Mm.
John, Martha, and Joan escape the scarecrows, but they see Father outside with the TARDIS. John recognizes it from his journal, but does not want it to be true. He doesn't want that life. He just wants to be John Smith, teacher. Martha reminds him that they need the doctor. Joan leads them to the little girl's home, which is now empty. She deduced that if daughter returned to the girl's home, she would have killed the parents. Tim arrives and gives Martha the watch. John doesn't want to open it, but the family has begun to bomb the village to flush him out. He suggests just giving them the watch, but Joan convinces him that they would only continue to destroy everything. She takes the watch and holds his hand. They both see the life that could have been, a life of them growing old together and having children, a life that the doctor could never have.
Get the tissues.
It reminded me of The Last Temptation of Christ. In the movie, The Last Temptation of Christ is on the cross. He sees what human life would have been, like he's
with Mary
married,
Magdalene, right?
Right. It gets a little weirder than that, yeah. But he has kids, he raises a family, and that's something that, you know, the doctor and the show, you know, the ordinary man being the thing that is most unique and most special about humanity is living a good life, whatever that entails for the individual. But this was his one opportunity to really have that we've seen in this series, and he knows that he can't. That's kind of cool that he got a chance to see it. Mm-hmm. And I think Joan sees it as well. Like, yes, they see it together.
That's how I interpret it too.
Yeah, yeah.
So sad.
It's so sad. This scene got me.
I mean, those three kids were never born. Their grandkids were never born. Doctor, you're selfish. Live this life. You know?
But at the same time, would they? Because of the family, may have just slaughtered the whole planet.
No.
They can't have that.
Agreed.
Yes. They can't have that.
You know, but I understand that, but it's just so devastating to know what
there's
could
that part
have
of you going, no, doctor, live that life.
Right. But then the world will be destroyed.
No, but it...
But
yeah, the needs of the few outweigh the needs of the many.
I love Jones.
It's just sad to think about that fact that he'll never have that.
Yeah. And I love everything about this scene. But Joan is so awesome in this scene where she deduces about the house, which is
great.
Tragic.
Yeah, but great.
Tragic.
For her. Smart.
She goes into the house. She puts her hand on the teapot. It's cold.
Stone cold.
So she knows she's right. And she says, how easily I accept these ideas. But it is just like, I'm believing in the truth. It's real. This is what's happening. And yeah. I how easily I can adapt to this, and I am not happy.
She's not just talking about the teapot. She's talking about reading the journal and the situation at hand.
The entire situation that they're going through, not just
the
parents have been killed by their...
She's basically conciding the fact, like, I am figuring this out. And it is actually true.
I love Joan here because she knows the truth. So she knows that when she says, but the doctor can't have that life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The doctor has so many adventures, but he can't have that life. And she makes that Humphrey Bogart decision in Casablanca where...
You'll regret it. Maybe not today.
Maybe not.
But someday.
Yeah. So it's like she makes that. She becomes that character where... You go and be better for the world.
I saw Joan saying that line to John Smith as a way to comfort John Smith. And John Smith has to die to become the doctor. And John Smith doesn't want to become the doctor. And he has to make that decision to save a bunch of lives. He has to kill John Smith and become the doctor. For me, when they see the life that they could have together as John Smith and Joan, it's almost like Joan is like telling John Smith that it's okay to not want to be the doctor, because the doctor has all these great adventures but could never have this one. So it's okay that you don't want to give up the life of John Smith.
It's kind of foreshadowing, like, I don't want to go.
I like how John is angry at Martha. I like
when
how
he says to her,
he
like,
lashes
what is it
out
you
and
do?
He's lashing out at Martha.
Yeah, that, I mean, I can, and I can see that Martha, it hurts her, but she also understands
totally.
The yeah. situation. Like, I can't get mad at him. He's not himself. But what you guys were saying about him and Joan, just I think also, too, John Smith slash the doctor has never really, and I don't mean this in any sort of lewd way, has never consummated. Well, that we know of, a real...
He has a granddaughter.
That's true. That's what I'm going to say. Well, like, this part of the doctor, like, Joan has had a marriage. She's had all that. So she kind of has perspective on love, whereas this John Smith doesn't. And he's acting like a child who's fallen in love for the first time.
Because also at the same time, yeah, Joan's been through this before, but she has also been through great loss.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
So she knows what's coming.
Right.
Whereas, she knows what choice she's...
Yeah.
You
or,
know.
Or he's... a child, because he's only 2 months old.
Right.
But also, the information he has of the doctor is what's... It's like, it's not something wild. You want to be. Martha's saying, well, he was lonely. That's what he wants me. And that's what you want me to be.
Yeah.
Tim then comes and says, the doctor is fire and ice and rage. It's like, that's what you want me to turn into, this
scared.
Monster.
But he also says he's wonderful.
Yeah.
Right. And then that's also when Martha then chimes in, and it's her devotion and belief of the doctor that shows up again. It's like, this is... You know, from her point of view, because she's already gone through the other part seemed like it's more tied to the infatuation. Uh-huh. Maybe something can happen. There is love. And I think in this episode, she gave that up. It's never going to be me, but she still has it. So to me, that rang more true, going, if it isn't with me, it's still this person, this entity is something amazing and we need, and it deserves my devotion.
What? It made me think of another Christ-like comparison where if you die, you'll be resurrected, and therefore I will believe in you.
Huh.
If you John Whoa. Smith dies, you will be resurrected as a godlike
character. As the doctor. And
there, you know,
Mark. Set the Jew.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that.
Well, I'm able to see things objectively when I don't believe it.
The makeup on Tennant was pretty good.
Oh, the old makeup?
Yeah. I did like that makeup.
I wish they would have given him contacts that made his eyes look a little cloudy. That would have sold it more for me. His eyes look too young.
I like the camera angle where they didn't have to put Joan into makeup.
Yeah. I think there was more of an aesthetic reason for that, though. I think it was more about his story. His story, yeah.
And when he starts to remember
when he snaps.
And talk like the doctor.
Oh, that
he
was
just
great.
Snaps right into it.
It's like, whoa, good. What a great... Yeah. I mean, he just transitioned really well.
It wasn't even everybody. It wasn't even like what he was... It wasn't even what he was saying. It was a total switch in personality, the way he was saying it.
The way he was standing, his mannerisms, and you know, the accent just kicks in.
Yeah. The cadence of how he speaks.
Yeah. Right, thank you, the cadence.
Is that what he sounds like?
Well, I think everybody, also the actors, played it really well, where it was just a acting bomb that went off, you know? So everyone's reacting to it and looking great.
Differently.
Totally different.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Everybody
like,
got it.
Tennant is like, great. What just happened? Joan is... really sad, right. And Martha is so happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, Martha is just like, yes.
Was Tim there?
I don't think we saw Tim.
He's like, did that just happen? Is that real? Yeah. Or did we all see that?
He's like, wait a minute, is that? Tim's looking at everybody else, being like, did you see that too?
He's like, these reactions are the same, but this one is different. What should mine be?
I told you.
Well, I don't think he's surprised because he's been seeing the doctor.
Yeah.
I think that what I found so endearing about Tennant's portrayal of him is how vulnerable and honest like his vulnerability was in his eyes and the fact he was falling in love. And that's something you don't usually see in the doctor. So I think that's what was sort of drawing me into this John Smith character is it was a very vulnerable performance. He's an incomplete person. Like, it's not even what this John Smith would do because he's being blocked because of he's only 2 months old and he's half a person.
But he's not an incomplete person. He's just put in a situation that he can't handle because he's
not... I don't see it that way. I see it as he's being blocked from doing what this John Smith would do because he doesn't have... He's never
invention of the TARDIS.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
Yeah, he is an invention of the TARDIS. I will give you that. But he's a complete invention of the TARDIS. That life that they see, I think, is... They would have had a
possibility. They would
have had a great, complete life.
But I don't... I'm saying...
Their kids would have died in World War II.
If this John Smith wasn't an invention of the TARDIS and put into the situation, I think he would have reacted differently. He may not have reacted as well as the Doctor. He may not have done anything right.
But why?
Why what?
Why would he have reacted differently? Why would the person...
Because I think...
I'm saying the character that we saw of John Smith, take everything else away. There's no perception filter. There's no Doctor. Right. You are just looking at a character. Right. What is wrong with this character?
I wouldn't watch a show about him. And that's what's wrong with the character.
Well, finish your question. I want to answer your question, but finish your question.
But that's fine. Nobody's going to make a... Because John Smith is ordinary. Mm-hmm. John Smith is just a teacher in a school, and John Smith didn't go to war. John Smith may go through the actions of teaching kids how to shoot guns, but he was never in the trenches. He was never there using his friend's body bags, but he knows people who does. So he's teaching them. And so when the moment comes, he's looking at all his boys that he teaches and that he has his own sense of caring for them and sees them now shooting people. Right. And in that moment, he can't fire.
Right.
But in that moment, he didn't. And to me, that's very human. I think that's a very legitimate action for a character of John Smith.
Right. I'm not just talking about that moment, though. I'm talking about if he was on the other side and someone else was acting like this, he may start putting pieces of the puzzle together and starting to possibly believe what's happening as opposed to being so resistant to this impossible idea as Joan did.
Like, I see it as a computer program that the code was put in, but there wasn't code for all of the problems, so there's some troubleshooting that happens in the situation.
Exactly.
So, like... The ones and zeros didn't fully complete the situation.
I see it as the opposite. I see it as the TARDIS did his job too well.
I think what Josh is saying, if I can try and middle ground this, is if the characters were reversed and Joan was the Doctor and she, you know, met John Smith, the character himself, John Smith, would have reacted like Joan is reacting. He would have seen the truth of it.
Sure.
And the reason he can't really accept or see the truth of it was because... It's being blocked because you're not supposed to know that.
I think that...
What Josh is saying. However, I'm also saying, however, that isn't the case. For John Smith, it's not Joan. You need to realize this. For John Smith, it's me.
Right. I think
this is me.
I think
Sorry.
Go ahead.
But I think he doesn't want it, and he's in denial. And he's going to fight it as long as he can possibly fight it. Which, by the way, he doesn't fight it the whole way.
I think it's a combination of the two.
I think he would have fought it against Joan. The only part I think was the Doctor was not firing. Some of the Doctor was there, and that's why he couldn't fire. That was part of the timer. That was part of it all. All the other battles as well. But I think John Smith would have fired, but because the Doctor was still there, that prevented him.
I agree with that.
I don't know. I just think it should be all or nothing. Either the Doctor, like John Smith, is like no Doctor at all if the TARDIS did such a good job creating him, or the Doctor is John Smith is like super gray because there's so much Doctor still there, and that's why he can't shoot, and that's why he can't do these things.
Because he mentioned Gallifrey, there is some Doctor there.
So that's why, it can't be one or the other. For me, it can't be that gray in the middle. It's one or the other. He's either John Smith or he's mixed.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
So then there's no, like, the TARDIS did such a great job, he's John Smith.
I think we know what to ask the viewer at the end of the episode. to lighten things up a little bit now that we've gone into a deep conversation. When they had the table read for these episodes, David Tennant introduced himself as playing the role of John Smith and not the Doctor.
I'm going to side with Rose. Where am I?
Stuck in another
Don't direction. You remember me?
She's in the book.
You know how we're joking about Rose would be like she wouldn't allow Joan? Seriously, think about it. Would Rose want a human doctor?
No.
Does she want the Gallifreyan
doctor?
She wants the Gallifreyan
doctor. Yeah. So, I mean, seriously, that just kind of went in my head. Where it was like, no, Rose would be like... Ew.
Rose wouldn't want John Smith at all.
Yeah. Okay, sorry.
She's already had Mickey Smith.
Yeah, that's basically who John Smith is. Someone who would do anything to be in love.
Later, John enters the alien ship, nervously fumbling along the controls, and begs the family to stop the bombing. They smell that he is still human, as he continues to support himself by leaning on the controls. He pleads with them to leave and offers them the watch. Baines takes it and throws John against more consoles. They open the watch, but it is empty. The doctor has already opened it and taken his essence back. He has been fumbling about so he could press all the buttons that will cause a power feedback in the ship. They are all able to make it out of the ship before it explodes.
This is the Columbo moment of the Doctor. We've mentioned that before, and this is where it is realized. And then they play that song again, All the Strange, Strange Things, which is great. I think it's beautifully used in this scene. And it's later on becomes theme of the 11th Doctor.
Really? I'll have to listen to that again.
Listen to it. It sounds very much like that theme.
Yeah. Did you catch that the sound effects for the buttons are the clockwork droids?
Yes, I did.
Oh.
It's such a distinctive
sound. Part of me thinks this is really cool and fun, but visually, he hit every button.
The only one that bothers me is when Baines throws him.
Yeah, at the very end.
And there's that specific cut of, yes. I'm looking and I grab all these.
Yeah.
Other than that, the ones earlier
I didn't really think much about.
Didn't they say that the ship was also acquired or stolen?
So yeah, it was stolen technology.
Maybe that's part of me rationalizing. Maybe they don't know every button.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah.
So what did the doctor do to hide his scent?
Ventriloquism. Auditory misdirection.
Yes.
Auditory ventriloquism.
Oh, yeah, that's what he said.
It's a throwaway line, but I'm fine with it.
Something they learned in grammar school.
Yeah, I just heard misdirection. I thought he was talking about throwing them the watch.
One thing that bothered me about the way that this, like, the transition to this scene, especially with the bombardment of the city or the town.
Village.
The village. Was I would have expected the spacecraft to be in flight for that bombardment.
It's like mortars.
Yeah, I guess so.
Which was another like World War One thing.
Because then at the time, like seeing the exteriors of them, they weren't arcing. They were like coming from
straight
above.
Down, right.
And then I thought that the doctor had needed to use the TARDIS to get up there. It just threw me off that they were still on the ground the first time watching it through.
Right. Well, maybe the effects house that did those shots didn't get the note that the spaceship was on the ground.
Right, they just heard spaceship.
Yes, bombardment spaceship, yes.
It was just a big arch.
Yeah.
So you only saw the coming down
it
part
all
of it.
The but
it
way wasn't even the world. Just the
coming. It was.
No, yeah. I know. Yeah. I agree with you that it was kind of odd.
It just threw me off as a viewer in the spatialness of everything.
This alien's technology, when it fires, it goes up straight and then does a 90 degree angle. And so there are no curves in this.
Yeah.
It goes like this and then like this.
Yes, exactly.
Nicely done for an auditory podcast. Yeah.
When you explained it, I showed it.
Hand motions were made, and hand motions were also made.
Yes.
The doctor had gone into hiding, not out of fear, but out of compassion. He pleaded with them to leave, but they didn't, and now must face an ominous doctor.
So that answers the question that I think Albert and I had when we were watching this. Like, why did the doctor make the choice between running for 3 months or hiding? That's
right. Or hiding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
And it's like, and then I'm like, oh, he hid to be kind. But instead he was like, I'm going to just hide. Maybe they'll,
Maybe they'll die in three months?
I don't know.
But either that wasn't kind either.
Yeah, it is because that's just
in a normal lifespan.
It's their dying their, in
well,
their
instead,
lifespan.
Instead, he could take out half a village with them. Like, see, that's
well,
the
that
thing.
Well, that was unintended consequences. Sure. But now that I'm saying it out loud, I'm like, it was like I either blow them to oblivion or I make the rest of their lives a hunt.
They like
to
hunting.
Pursue me. No.
Yeah. Right. But also, they're making their choices.
Oh, and it goes
and he's making his. I'm not going to actively be the person to kill them.
Right.
Okay.
Doctor doesn't kill.
It's a Disney death, you know? Yeah. You jump into the trees and
the only good
just
one is
happen,
fall.
You know? Yeah. Well, it's happen all, to choke themselves or hit a rock or...
It's also the idea of the Doctor intentionally doing what he thinks is right and good, but people still get hurt by it. Mm-hmm. Oops.
He separates the family and traps them in places in which they can live, well, exist forever. Father in chains forged from a dwarf star, mother in an event horizon of a collapsing galaxy, daughter in a mirror, every mirror but just out of visual range, son in a time lock as a scarecrow. He then returns to see Joan. She can't look at him because he looks so much like John Smith, but it's not him. The doctor says that John is somewhere inside of him, and when she asks if he would change back, he tells her no. He invites her to travel with him, and they can start again. She declines because John is dead. She wants an answer to one question, though. If the doctor had never come to this village, would all these people still be alive? He doesn't reply, and she dismisses him.
So good. First off, the fury of a Time Lord. Yikes.
That's why Tim was so scared.
Don't make him mad.
So why do they live forever and not die in 3 months?
Because he creates the spaces, yeah. Time locks.
He time locks, yeah.
On all of them?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
So the chains I didn't get.
Yeah, the chains I don't get.
I think it's because it's from a dwarf star. There's some sort of event horizon thing in it.
The gravity well of those chains.
Yeah, I liked it the first time I saw it. And then afterwards, it's, this doesn't make sense kind of idea. And then the whole Bloody Mary part of it.
Oh, I know, right? Thanks, writers.
So that explains that one with daughters.
Part of me loves all that stuff. And part of me thinks it's a lot of Moffat-isms.
Though he didn't write it. But it seems Moffat-esque, he's
involved with the show, yeah. It seems very Moffat-esque to make
he
him
wasn't
out.
He wasn't at this point.
Russell was the showrunner.
Well, it seems that bit of the Moffat-ism where the Doctor is so much larger than life, almost godlike.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree.
But as a story point, I like it.
As a story point, I love it. I love the ideas of it. If I wasn't to think ahead about that, I think it's really, really cool.
And I think that's why I like both of these episodes, is that they're pretty much self-contained.
Yes. And my other favorite part of the scene is when she tells him he was braver than you are.
Yes.
Because he actually died for you.
Yeah.
You won't change for him.
I think the line was, he died and you just changed.
No, No,
we both have it wrong, Josh.
He was braver than you in the end, that ordinary man. You chose to change, and he chose to die.
Again, it's a godlike thing.
Yeah.
God came to Earth, became man.
Totally.
And
I
then
love it.
After he dies,
he sacrificed part of himself.
Part of himself, and then he goes back to being a god. So, and then having all these godlike wrath, vengeance to the people that he's punishing.
You will suffer for eternity.
You suffer for like hellfire and brimstone. I don't know. It's just very godly, ominous power happening there. I love this look that I'm getting.
I'm just thinking, that's a lovely story written by 3rd century people.
Yes. Oh, of course.
Oh, it is. Definitely love it. Not 3rd century, probably more like 20th. 25th, 30th, maybe a little further down.
I do like the combination of this callous doctor coming in, who is sort of the doctor you don't like, but he's also like, come with me. Like, it's almost, he's kind of putting himself on the table and owning his own callousness in a way. So it's this, it's this distance, but also being totally authentic with being distant.
Yeah. It does have a bit of a, there is that moment where it's like the first time he says, come with me, I do kind of viscerally react of, oh no, because he is seeming very, very not John Smith. And then he kind of brings it back down to John Smith is in here.
Mm-hmm. But I think that he wants her to come.
He does want her to come.
He sees she would be awesome as a companion and also enjoy learning all these different things. Mm-hmm. If the situation were different, she would say yes. But she sees him as a murderer. I mean, not only to John, but to all these people. Because, and her line was just, so what must I look like to you now that you're this great omnipotent being? I'm just a lonely woman.
Right. Well, just the fact that too, that you would let these people die carelessly. You would come to this planet on a whim.
It's again like religion. You meet Jesus, seems like such a kind, compassionate human being, and then you see the destruction that comes with God.
Right.
And you're nothing like Jesus.
So the family
she's all like, ugh.
So the family of blood is sort of like the Crusades, which was about the cup of blood.
There you go. No, it just kind of shows that I saw a glimpse of you, and that's the only part I liked.
Right.
So you're asking me to go with you, but that small glimpse is like too small of who you are.
Right.
So the rest of you, I dislike, and I don't want to be with you.
But it's heartbreaking because she still did fall for that piece.
Oh, yeah.
And and you can see that she knows it. She knows, like, I tapped into that love again, but it's
and
not.
I'm so disappointed.
And even if I did say yes to it, it wouldn't even be there once I took a hold of it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder why the doctor chose to go to there at that time. I mean, it would have worked. The plan would have worked. He had the other, you know, of the 23 notes for Martha that may have done other things. So they didn't affect the people's lives. You know, so in a month, they could have left and not have.
Yeah, but death always follows the doctor. We know that.
True. But just I want to know what other things were put in position, why he chose
maybe this. Maybe it was the TARDIS that chose
because it was Tim who, because he was psychic, picked up.
And maybe that was it. It was the TARDIS knew where to land.
Or the TARDIS needed to change Tim's life.
It's weird because I think of this story and what if Tim wasn't there? The things would have gone to plan.
There would be no story. It would have gone.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But you know what I mean?
Fine. Nobody would have died.
Like, he would have found the watch when he needed to find it. Martha would have said, open the watch.
Or
that's a good point.
Yeah.
The predestination of God that needed to come in and change Tim's life because Tim was going to do something for them. Sure. It's just the whole idea that, like, Tim has a greater purpose. Like, he lives all the way to old age and achieves something during World War One.
Right,
like he achieves things. Probably World War One and World War Two, because he was a child in World War One.
Yeah.
And my heart just goes out for Joan when she says you can go. Yeah. And she misses the doctor. It's like that's just so sad.
So well done. And there's that moment she does see him and say, can you change back? Yes. Mm-hmm. Will you? No. And that reminds me of, can you change back? Do you want me to? From the Children in Need special. And it is just kind of like different reaction, different times.
Which is the Children in Need special?
The one where
he's just regenerated from Christopher Eccleston. And Rose is like, no, I don't like this. Can you change back? And he's like, any immediately. And he was so happy up until that point. And that question kind of bursts his bubble. And he's like, do you want me to? And she's like, yeah. And he's like, no, I can't. And this one he can, but he won't.
What was the fruit in his robe? That
Satsuma.
It wasn't pears.
No. It was two Satsuma, so it was a pear.
Oh.
Wow.
No. It was like a Doppler effect.
Then Brian, then
Kelsey. I really wish this was a vidcast.
And like Frank and
The Doctor and Martha meet at the TARDIS, where he says it's time to leave. Tim arrives and thanks them. He now knows that his visions are real and knows what must be done. The Doctor gives Tim the watch, which is now just a watch, for good luck. A few years later, during the war, Tim and Hutchinson are in the middle of the trenches, and Tim realizes that it's time. The bomb is coming, and at the last moment, he moves Hutchinson and himself out of harm's way. In modern day, Tim, now an old man in a wheelchair, sees the Doctor and Martha, who are there to honor those who served in the war. Tim still has the pocket watch.
I'm right there with you, Brian. That scene just, I don't know, they didn't need to edit, but it's, they got me thinking. Because my family has served in the military, and my two brothers are there, and my youngest brother's there now. I don't know. Military has a special place in my heart, so this reminds me of, like, Private Ryan at that ending, where Private Ryan says to his family, you know, was I a good man? This reminds me a lot of that.
Yeah.
And the red poppy is for the Remembrance Day. Since 1921, it is to commemorate military personnel who have died in war. And so I think it's great that Martha pins it on to the Doctor at the end.
And they use the poppies because there was a poem that was written in Flanders Field. And the author wrote the poem because poppies were the first flowers to regrow in the fields.
After the battles. Yeah.
And the poppies were red, and it reminded him of all the blood.
It's also another Wizard of Oz reference.
And Remembrance Day is November 11th.
Yep.
11th hour of the 11th month.
Of the 11th day.
No, 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month.
Every veteran in this episode died except for him.
The Doctor?
No, except for Tim.
Oh, except for Tim.
Except for Tim. So the veteran outside, I don't want to call him begging.
The Crimean War,
From the Crimean War, the headmaster of the Boer War, and Tim was the soldier at the end of old age.
Because Hutchinson
was
older. Well, he's older, so he died at
But he died not in war.
Not in war, yeah.
Yeah, but we don't see him in the show.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, but and then the men in the show who are representative of veterans, he ended up living and getting all those medals and obviously being of use to the world. Yeah. Well, I'm saying that puts a button on that idea of the Doctor being there created that. Because I think if Tim didn't encounter the Doctor, he wouldn't have become that soldier.
Mm-hmm.
The war hero.
The war, he would have gone crazy because of his psychic abilities. So maybe with all those people that did die in the village, the doctor's influence actually saved many more.
Mm-hmm. His vision, we never saw the bomb actually hit them.
Right, right.
So it could be that nothing changed. It was nothing the way it was going
to be. Yeah. Well, I think
but that... it was just a forewarning to go, this is the time you have to move.
Exactly. That's exactly
yeah, what I don't think he changed anything.
I don't think it changed
anything. No, yeah. But I think he knew what time it was when that bomb was falling. Mm-hmm. So he gets the watch.
The watch is a reminder.
The watch, so we know, oh, it's time to move.
It gives him that courage to do what he was supposed to do.
Right.
Yeah.
The actor that plays old Tim is Hugh Reese. He did a great job.
He did.
He read a lot. You could read a lot on his face.
Yeah.
He had no lines.
I do want to mention that because there was a female vicar.
All right.
The Remembrance Day.
Yes, you're right.
And I think that was definitely put in to go, no, from the whole story of 1913, women have made it to a certain point. Maybe not completely, but I do like that point that they put it and definitely made it, you know, a female character.
I looked that up. Women become vicars in the 90s in the Church of England.
England is so much more advanced than the United States.
Well, they used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everyone's going...
Well, yeah, they can't even keep the toilet tanks on the ground.
This whole story is adapted from a Seventh Doctor novel written by Paul Cornell, who also wrote the screenplay for these episodes. In that novel, it is actually the Seventh Doctor and his companion Bernice Summerfield who are in the roles of that are changed by here by the Tenth Doctor and Martha Jones. And real quick, Bernice is from the 26th century and she's an archaeologist. And I think she's only been in novels.
Yeah, she was never on TV.
And something that I found interesting, a main difference in the novel, is that the Doctor wasn't hiding as a human.
Yes.
He chose to become a human to study human nature.
Yeah.
Mm. And no pocket watch.
There's no fob watch.
Did they He's hide a cri- him it's in a cricket ball.
Yeah. So that's why the cricket ball in the first episode when he throws it to save the baby.
The nod to that.
Yeah.
But I think it was Russell who said, "No, he needs something that can be opened."
Yeah. And so that's how they came up with the pocket watch,
cuz I love that it's a pocket watch.
And then the pocket watch is also the inspiration for the Gallifreyan writing. It's all circular.
Is it the first time we've seen something like that?
Not the Eighth Doctor had a pocket watch.
I want to say this is like this is where Gallifreyan writing expanded.
No, I mean the writing. I mean the type of writing.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, like we probably saw Gallifreyan writing before, but
I don't think it
limited.
Looked like this. I don't think it looked like this though.
But I'm sure they built on what existed before, and this is when the Gallifreyan writing explodes into.
Gotcha.
It's a series of circles.
Gotcha.
And then the aliens or the villains of this particular story in the novels, they take everything from the human host that they're inhabiting, like the little girl with the balloon. The balloon is part of the alien, and so they abandon that idea for, I guess, just productionary limitations.
Yeah, like the balloon sucks people's faces.
So the clothes are also part of the alien.
They kept some of it because she still had the balloon.
Yes, yeah. But the practicality of it.
Right.
Was not there.
I will say the effects that were used in this were pretty seamless. The light, the force field effect that they used, and even that smoke effect in the first episode.
It's kind of funny because Russell's idea when this first started was, let's have an episode without special effects. There aren't many, but...
But they use the money well.
Eventually, they're like, no, we have to have something. But boy, the location shooting.
Yeah.
Oh, the location of this episode. And the costumes...
This is what BBC excels at.
Wow.
Past, period old episodes, pieces. Period pieces, yes.
They all just look perfect. They all just look lived in enough. Oh, yeah, I love the Doctor's room.
Yeah.
Does this episode live up to the promise of the first episode being human nature?
Yes.
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 Yeah, this was a solid two-parter.
I think the first episode was pretty much a standalone episode if you would have changed the ending so it wasn't a cliffhanger. It had so much... involved in it, that it was a good standalone. Mm-hmm. And this really expanded on that, like you're saying. And unlike some of the other cliffhangers, it didn't resolve that first part of it in the first few seconds. It really felt like the story continued.
Just continued.
Halfway through this one big story.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of our two-parters, like... Once we get to the second episode, like new things are introduced that kind of feel like they come out of nowhere because there's no groundwork for it in the first half.
Yeah. And it didn't need any padding to stretch it to a full two episodes.
Yeah. The end probably felt very satisfying because there were three endings. It was ending with him and Joan, it was ending with the villain, and then there was the ending with Tim. And then
Which had two endings.
Yeah.
So by the time it was over, you felt pretty satisfied.
Sorry, to answer your question, Eugene, yes.
And Baines was much better.
And Baines was much better.
Baines was much better in this
one. That's good to hear.
Yes, Baines is much better in this
episode. I don't know if they did the fish angle lens as much. or his face wasn't as close. Mm-hmm. But I think he had more also to act with rather than just giving that look. He is creepy.
He's good at playing creepy
characters you're not supposed to like. So for all you know, he's doing his job.
Yeah.
But you said in the first episode you didn't like Jenny.
Who said that Jenny is just as bad as Bane?
No, I didn't say she's just as bad. I said she just had that same affectation when she gets taken over.
But I think that the actress portrays it in a much more effective manner than the actor who plays Bane.
Well, and Jenny, you got to see being much. She was a human. She was Martha's friend, and she was smiling and laughing.
Yes. Seeing the difference between those two people was a great job.
Yeah.
But even in that scene where Martha's confirming that they're all dead and not just taken over, Jenny is the one in the forefront.
Right.
And Jenny has that thing where she's staring right into the camera. And I like that moment where she's like, you know, oh yeah, Jenny with all that screaming. That would be a difficult line to deliver. But I think the actress does it really, really well.
Yeah.
And I don't think the actor who does Bane's could have done that line well.
We'll go over the top. Now, she's very good, seeing how sweet and nice she was. So when the first episode started playing and she's this sweet little nice like lady, I'm like, oh, wow, that's right. And so I thought she did an excellent job.
There was a lot of lines that were kind of interjected to help the story along. Like the one with Tim from Bane's, the reanimate from Bane's. Yeah. Like, I don't even think that was on screen. I think you just just heard it.
Well, maybe we should put in a line there where he says reanimate.
Yeah. Fine. Reanimate. Happy now.
Because the viewers are stupid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the same cry with the Tim, like, Tim line.
Yeah, yeah. That stuff all happens after everything's all cut and put together, reshoots are over, and someone goes, well, how is the public going to not be stupid?
The second part did live up to the first part.
And the way I feel is, if it weren't for the second part, I would hate the first part. So I think the second part is better than the first part. So more than lives up. It's like amazingly better. So if the first episode was a standalone, it would be one of my worst episodes.
Because of some of the things at the end about the father being in the chains and all that.
Star.
I would say it's about a 96-97% lives up to it. There's a few little things, but we're not giving it a complete 100. But yes, it does. So that gets an A. I say it lives up to it, yes.
What was it that Tim said? Right. He was getting like 96, 95 marks in all of his classes. Well, you should be at the top.
Right. It's just a little clarification, though. I think, you know, for storyline, that was a really nice ending for a scary story and how they did it. It just needed a little more clarification. But that's only nitpicking. Somebody's going to find a person stuck in a scarecrow costume when they're leveling off to build them all.
Okay, yes. I thought that too until I realized that he froze him in a moment of time.
So he's only in that
moment. He's only in that split second. He's not progressing.
But wasn't he protecting the fields?
For that split second.
Oh.
And I wanted a little bit more just clarification, but that could be just me. That's why I was just saying I was a little confused.
That's a second, third viewing kind
of. It's just me.
This lives up. You've heard our thoughts. What do you think of the John Smith persona? Is he a fully realized person, or are there influences of the TARDIS in him? Let us know your thoughts. Email us at whoknewpodcast@gmail.com. That wraps up Family of Blood. Join us next time when the future becomes the present.
You've just listened to an episode of Who Knew?
Our wonderful theme music is by Michael Grady.
Find him on Facebook
at The Universe Explodes.
All our episodes are engineered by very own Auburn.
Find me at auburnbinkley.com.
You can find this show in several places.
Follow us on Twitter at Who Knew Podcasts.
Subscribe, review, and listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher.
Or our YouTube channel, youtube.com/WhoKnewPodcast.
All our episodes are on WhoKnewPodcast.com.
You can leave comments there or email us at
WhoKnewPodcast@gmail.com.
This podcast is inspired by Doctor Who,
the longest running sci-fi show in history,
and especially the revival spearheaded by Russell T. Davis.
Thanks to Russell,
Sidney Newman,
Verity Lambert,
Ron Grainer,
and all those involved in the adventures of our favorite Time Lord.
Your work continues to inspire and entertain.
Is it okay if I talk with my mouth full?
No.
Yes,
please continue chewing.
But chew right here.
Just unplug his mic.